Welcome to Within the Realm. I'm your host, Steve Garrett. At Within the Realm, we try to find stories off the beaten path, or tales behind the things that you think you may know. We believe that everything has a story, and it's all within the realm. And today's story involves my hometown, and the unseen forces that brought it about. There was a time when rails were king. If you wanted to get somewhere fast, you were riding a train. Trains connected the far-flung places in the United States to each other. My town was no different than many others. Many a night, I fell asleep to the steady rhythm of 100 or more cars traveling north or south of my hometown, Stillwell, Oklahoma. Although I grew up in the age of the automobile and air travel, passenger rail service was breathing its last. The railroad that served our town tried to compete with the emerging modes of travel, cutting costs and eliminating unprofitable services. But when the United States Postal Service announced that it would no longer be shipping second, third, or fourth class mail by rail, that was all she wrote. It had been the mail that had kept the passenger service alive. Without that steady source of revenue, the decision was made to end passenger service on our rail line. In 1967, a press release was sent to the news outlets along the track that in the next several months, passenger service would be discontinued. Quote, "We deeply regret the passing of an era," unquote, stated the release. Over the next few months, life went on. Eventually, it was announced that the passenger rail service on the Kansas City Southern Line would end in late fall of 1969. That was the summer I turned 5 years old. It was a good summer. We watched men walk on the moon. Our preference was for Buzz Aldrin. I think we had a thing for the underdog. On the radio airwaves was a cleverly disguised anti-war song called "Ruby, Don't Take Your Love to Town" by the First Edition, with vocals provided by a then-unknown Kenny Rogers. Also a huge hit was Johnny Cash's version of a Shel Silverstein poem, "A Boy Named Sue." It was the parenting manual for our neighborhood, two-thirds this song, and a final third ignoring anything in Dr. Spock's baby book. It seems our parents agreed with the railroad company that the end of an era was happening before our eyes. The depot, the connection for many years between our town and Kansas City and New Orleans and beyond, was soon to be shuttered. The town, which had once faced the railroad with its busiest stores within a block of the depot, had moved most of its commerce two or three blocks west along the highway that ran through town. The closing of the passenger service would basically sever our tie with the railroad, only to be reminded of the heyday of the rails when we heard the click-clack of the passing train. A group of parents determined that us kids should make a trip on the train, just so that we could say that we rode the rails at least once. An excursion was planned, and in late summer, a couple of carloads of kids were whisked to the depot in Sallisaw, Oklahoma, to catch the train north. We were lined up against a station wagon, and Polaroids of the group were taken, as was the custom. We boarded the train, the Southern Belle, the sweetheart of America's trains, to make our roughly 30-mile trek north. I was assigned to stick with my older brother. I, as the unwanted but forced tag-along, cramped his style, and he passively let me know it. We sat on finely upholstered seats as the Ozark scenery swept past us. I don't recall the scenery, but I do recall the interior of that car. It was pretty ostentatious. Dark green upholstery, worn brass foot rails, and gleaming aluminum everywhere in the dimly lit car. Even as a newly minted 5-year-old, I could tell the style and the architecture of this car was from an older time, soon to be gone. A curious steward, an older man, asked my brother, who was one of the older kids on our excursion, why it was that this particular group was on his train. I was in awe of the steward's jacket. It was pressed and the whitest cloth I'd ever seen. The steward turned his attention to me and asked me a question. I'm sure it was innocent enough. I remember him being friendly. I'm sure his innocent question was something like, "How do you like my train?" Being shy and not having my mother to hide behind, I just froze and didn't answer. Thankfully, and oh so helpful, my brother explained that I was an idiot. During our trip, we were treated to a Dixie cup of Coca-Cola, a treat usually reserved for the weekends. It was a big deal. All in all, our train ride lasted about a half hour, but the mission was accomplished. We were able to say that we had taken the train. But that trip wouldn't have happened if our town and the railroad did not have the relationship. The town, Stillwell, owed its very existence to the railway, and its name to the man who built it. It had been established only about 75 years prior to our trip on the Southern Bell. The man behind the railroad? Arthur Stillwell. But the whole enterprise would not have happened, except for the brownies that whispered advice into Arthur's ear. Yes, you heard me right. Brownies. At least that's what he called them. But let's back up a bit. Arthur Stillwell was born in 1859 in Rochester, New York. He became a traveling salesman and devised the idea of providing railroad timetables at no cost to the companies by selling advertising on the cards. He finagled free fare from railroads and free meals and lodging from his advertisers while conducting his business and also courting his childhood sweetheart, whose family had recently moved to Virginia. He soon married his sweetheart, Jenny Wood, and the couple moved to Kansas City. After a tumultuous year in Kansas City, where the Stillwells spent much of their time ill, the couple moved to Chicago, where he sold life insurance for the Travelers Company. While there, he introduced the idea of the coupon annuity life insurance policy. This type of policy paid the holder an annuity after a certain age. Stillwell had made the arrangements with the company that he would receive a fee for each policy sold in addition to his other commissions. Soon he became what would be considered comfortable for the time, and he and his wife returned to Kansas City, where he took up selling and developing real estate. He became involved in the building of the Kansas City Suburban Belt Railway, which tied the meatpacking plants in Kansas City, Kansas, to Independence. Along that route, he built Fairway Park, the electric park, to keep the trains moving on the weekends. The building of the Suburban Belt Railway was just the beginning for Arthur Stillwell. He envisioned a connection between Kansas City and the Gulf of Mexico. He began buying rail lines along the proposed route and building track to connect them. The easy thing to do was to terminate the line at Galveston or Houston, established cities with ports. But he opted to build an entirely new city and port on the Texas coast. He would name it after himself, Port Arthur, Texas. Just a few years later, a major hurricane hit Galveston, leaving in its wake deaths in the hundreds and almost total destruction. Arthur's young rail line avoided that. Another serendipitous occurrence was just months after the completion of Port Arthur, a massive oil field, Spindletop, was discovered just miles away, assuring the success of the company to become known as the Kansas City Southern. But by the time these things had come to pass, investors that Stillwell would come to call the Cannibals of Wall Street had forced the railroad into receivership over an unpaid printing bill in the amount of $44. Although the presidency of the Kansas City, Pittsburgh, and Gulf line had been wrested from him The populace of Kansas City understood what he had done for the city by connecting them to the Gulf. An elaborate dinner was given in his honor. At the dinner, Arthur announced a new plan. Quote, "Place the Pacific Ocean 400 miles nearer to Kansas City." End quote. This grand vision, the Kansas City, Mexico, and Orient Railroad, proposed to connect Kansas City to a port on the west coast of Mexico, 400 fewer miles than the distance to San Francisco, and 400 miles less of track, with the potential of trade with the Pacific Rim. The Mexican Revolution thwarted the plan. Pancho Villa himself, once a contractor with the company, through threats and violence, ended work on the line in Mexico. The unfinished rail line went into receivership. A few years later, the trustee of that receivership, William Kemper of Kansas City, discovered oil beneath the tracks, which contributed to the making of his family fortune. After these reversals, the Stillwells moved to New York City. During his track-building heyday, Arthur had built 2,300 miles of track, over 300 companies, and established 40 towns throughout Missouri, Arkansas, Indian Territory, and Texas. What was it that made Arthur Stillwell such a visionary? He gave the credit to spirits. He originally called them brownies, and later called them hunches. But voices that came to him in dreams directed the great successes of his life. When he could not find a way to connect the ends of his suburban belt line because another line's tracks blocked his path, the brownies provided the solution, a bridge over the blockade. The brownies made the suggestion to build south to the Gulf in the first place. It was the brownies that suggested avoiding Galveston and building his own city and port. The brownies provided the vision for the track to the Pacific. His interactions with the brownies was not a closely guarded secret. He was a spiritualist. Later in his life, he corresponded quite a bit with Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of one Sherlock Holmes, who is also a spiritualist. Doyle said of Stillwell, quote, "No man living has the psychic experience of Arthur Stillwell," end quote. Arthur left no record of his thoughts about the brownies' silence on the matter of the corrupt business partners that stole his rail line from him, or the lack of advance warning of the Mexican Revolution, which ended his career as a captain of industry. The Stillwells, who had no children, lived in an apartment in New York City, where he wrote plays, poems, and hymns, and the occasional book, Railing Against the Cannibals of Wall Street. He died of apoplexy in 1928 at the age of 69. His distraught wife, also a believer in the brownies, jumped to her death 8 floors below, 13 days after Arthur passed away. She left a note saying she was joining her husband on another plane. At the time, their estate was worth less than $1,000, and their cremated remains have never been located. Had he not listened to the ghostly whispers in his ear, my hometown would have never been built, and the lone train ride I ever experienced would not have happened. He is remembered in Kansas City with a meeting room named for him in Union Station. The shuttered depot in the town that bears his name has been restored and now houses the Adair County Historical and Genealogical Association. It has reassumed its position of importance along the now realigned highway. And it's not only Arthur that has left a lasting mark. A pedestrian bridge, arching the tracks from Union Station to Kansas City's Crossroad District, is the same bridge that was constructed to complete his Kansas City Suburban Railway. And that bridge was constructed at the suggestion of the brownies. It makes me wonder whose ear they whispered into to preserve the bridge.
I think there's a lesson we can learn from Arthur. No, it's not always listen to the brownies. It's not about the voices. It's about the vision. Arthur's vision had a huge impact on Kansas City and the entire Midwest, an impact that still is evident to this day. But then there are smaller moments that exist because of that great vision of his. Moments in the lives of thousands of people over the course of a century that without Arthur and the brownies, those moments wouldn't exist. Moments like newlyweds catching the train for a honeymoon in New Orleans, or boys returning from two world wars, or even a bunch of kids taking a ride, their first and their last, on the rails.
Just a few days before the release of this episode, I learned that one of the kids on that train ride with me passed away. Jody Eden had been my friend my entire life. She was there from the start. There is never a time in my life that I don't remember not knowing her. I dedicate this episode to her memory. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Within the Realm. We hope you enjoyed it. You can find show notes on this episode and a full archive of all episodes at our website, withinpodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss a single episode. You can find us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and the usual podcast channels. If you've enjoyed our show, be sure to tell your friends. We want your feedback. You can communicate with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Special music for this episode was provided by Spring Eyes. And, as always, thanks for listening.